Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a long-awaited ruling by U.S. District Judge Carl Barbier that found BP acted with gross negligence in setting off the biggest offshore oil spill and worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. Cynthia Sartou, the Executive Director of the Gulf Restoration Network, joins us to discuss how BP, who have already stated they will appeal the federal judge's decision, still actively fights claims by oil spill victims and challenges settlements while spending millions on advertising campaigns portraying themselves as concerned environmentalists and generous benefactors while claiming to have successfully restored the Gulf's ecosystems. Then, with discussions underway at the NATO summit on collective action to confront the Islamic State, we will look into the role of Saudi Arabia as the religious and ideological guide of the violent Sunni Salafist movement and speak with Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. We'll discuss the influence of Wahhabi religious doctrine in both the newly insurgent Islamic State and other radical movements worldwide, like the Taliban, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and Al-Qaeda. Then finally, with this year's 2014 midterms shaping up as the dark money election, we will speak with Sheila Krumholz, the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, who tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. She joins us to discuss the massive influx of unattributed dark money operating under the social welfare rubric of the IRS 501c4 nonprofit vehicle that is pouring into the upcoming November elections. We will also talk about her latest article at CNN, Will Eric Cantor Help Wall Street? And joining us now is Cynthia Sartou, who is the Executive Director of the Gulf Restoration Network, a diverse coalition of 45 local, regional, and national environmental and citizens groups committed to uniting and empowering people to protect and restore the resources of the Gulf region. She is a lawyer with a Master's in Law and Marine Affairs and has written extensively and testified about the environmental issues affecting the Gulf of Mexico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cynthia Sartou.
Well, thank you for having me.
And this ruling that came down, I guess it's, what, better late than never?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we've been waiting a long time for this ruling, and it really vindicates a lot of us who have thought all along that BP was, grossly negligent in what it did. So it's a pretty happy day for most of us.
Well, apparently this ruling, which puts most of the blame on BP, opens the way up for fines of up to $18 billion under the Clean Water Act?
Correct. It does. Yes. It definitely opens the way for a much higher amount of fines that could come to the Gulf to help us restore the destruction that has occurred here.
So instead of accepting responsibility, BP has been engaged in a long, drawn-out legal fights, along with stating today that they're going to fight this decision. They've been actively fighting oil spill victims, have been pursuing claims against BP under a settlement that the company entered into voluntarily. Rather than accept any responsibility and end these legal fights, they've held up and challenged a lot of settlements, which, a lot of lawyers have got agreements on, and they won't start, paying out these appropriately imposed fines. So to your mind, Cynthia, in spite of what they say in their advertising on television, and I'd like to get an understanding of how much they've spent on advertising as opposed to how much they have held up in terms of paying legitimate claims. But is that, to your mind, their MO to...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been amazing to me. Between the PR campaign, which has had to have cost in the hundreds of millions, I would think. I don't know. I'm not a PR expert, but it's my understanding that there are ad campaigns all over, interestingly, not here, but all over the rest of the United States. There are ad campaigns about how much they've done and how great they've been at a time when there are still hundreds of tar balls washing up on the beaches. Every time there's a storm, there's tar mats, there's still oil in wetlands, we have dolphins that are dying. And every time anybody raises any science at all that shows an impact that they think, that the scientists think is linked to BP, BP starts to fight the science, saying it's totally unsound, it's not sound science, it's not good science, it's clearly not appropriate. And then they're fighting the claims. You know, so the claims, it's my understanding in the stories that I've, you know, seen, they haven't even really paid out that many claims. I mean, that claims facility has not approved that many claims if you look at the number of claims that have actually been filed. But BP is fighting all of them, calling it what used to be a defense attorney, which I find really interesting. You know, the head of that claims department is, in fact, or that claims facility is, in fact, a defense attorney, not a plaintiff's attorney. And so now they're even questioning his sort of, I guess, fairness and whether there's a conflict of interest. I mean, if they spent the money they're spending on PR and fighting these claims on cleaning up the mess and restoring the wetlands, we'd be probably, you know, not halfway there, but we'd be a good way toward actually achieving restoration and what they say they've done.
And my understanding is that the area around where the spill took place is a vast dead zone. Is that true?
I don't know that it's a vast. On the bottom, it is.
That's on the bottom I'm talking about.
Yeah, on the bottom it, in fact, is. And there are plumes that are still moving around the Gulf that scientists are trying to pinpoint. And it's my understanding they're finding damage to corals. And it's, you know, part of it was that BP was so intent on getting rid of any visual sign of oil that they sprayed dispersant on it. And as opposed to really assisting, this is my understanding, in getting rid of or biodegrading that oil, what it did is sunk it to the bottom. And so now it's had a horrible effect on the bottom of the ocean in many areas of the Gulf.
And again, I'm speaking with Cynthia Thartu, who is the Executive Director of the Gulf Restoration Network, a diverse coalition of 45 local, regional, and national environmental and citizens groups committed to uniting and empowering people to protect and restore the resources of the Gulf region. She is a lawyer with a Master's in Law and Marine Affairs, and has written extensively and testified about environmental issues affecting the Gulf of Mexico. But this ruling by Judge Barbier is a very, very technical one. It's very detailed. I mean, it really does show that this judge has painstakingly done his homework and recreated a total timeline. He really takes you through a series of preventable problems that even the BP rig's crew understood, which led to the blowout, and overseers and crew members on the rig ignored test results that should have shown them that there was some danger. And in fact, according to the judge, if they'd heeded these warnings, they could have prevented the disaster even in its final minutes, he wrote in his decision.
Yeah, it's not surprising to me. I mean, we've said all along that part of the problem on a lot of these oil rigs or these facilities as they're trying to bring in these wells is that, and I don't know if this continues, but the normal course of business was to provide these people with huge financial incentives for bringing wells in early. And because there had never been a blowout, they became very, I think, dismissive that anything significant could ever happen. When I would go to public hearings, I was told this over and over and over again by the agency and by the industry, that it was just impossible that anything of the magnitude that I tried to raise would ever happen. And so, it does not surprise me at all that this occurred, that they were so, I guess, intent on bringing the well in early, and it's my understanding they had a lot of trouble with this well to begin with, which you would think would make them more cautious, but instead seemed to drive them to try to bring it in sooner, you know, so that they would overcome whatever delays they'd had. And they just continually ignored warning signs to, of course, their detriment and the detriment of the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, apparently the judge, in his decision, has apportioned 67% of the blame for the spill on BP, 30% on Transocean, and 3% on Halliburton, who put in the cement at the wellhead that proved to be inadequate. What's your sense then of I mean, we've already discussed the fact that now the BP has opened up to $18 billion under the Clean Water Act. They're fighting this. What's your sense of how well they'll do in court? I mean, this is, I imagine the people in your neighborhood down there in the Gulf are not too happy with it. If the rest of the country has been subject to this bogus propaganda campaign by BP to paint themselves as environmentalists, and that this whole problem's been solved, and if, as you say, people down there know it hasn't been solved, and they must be aware of this ruling, what do you see as the next step?
Well, I think that, you know, we hope that BP would step up to the plate and actually try to come to settlement. But I fear that, as Exxon did after the Exxon Valdez, what they're going to do is continue to appeal this ruling and try to make the people of the Gulf look like greedy. You know, I mean, I think that's the most insulting thing for most of the people in the Gulf who suffered economic and even personal injury after this disaster, is that the ads not only talk about how they personally have stepped up to the plate, but really seem to paint people of the Gulf as, you know, corrupt and really trying to bilk them of dollars they're not entitled to. And it's really offensive. They haven't made good on their promises to clean up the environment. They haven't made good on their promises to help people. And instead, they're spending all this money fighting this and taking a page from Exxon's playbook after the Exxon Valdez. They're simply going to try to delay and delay and delay this until they wear the plaintiffs and the government down to try to, you know, save a bunch of money. To me, that's it. They don't really want to make it right. They simply want a corporate, you know, approach to this that reduces the amount they're going to have to pay by wearing people down.
Well, it would seem though that the government, the U.S. government, could do something, because in April, the United States Environmental Protection Agency lifted its suspension of BP's ability to get federal contracts. So they've deemed the corporation once again fit to do business with the government. After this ruling, that's pretty hard to swallow.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I'm disappointed with EPA, and I know they've come under a lot of political pressure to release that. And the saddest thing, which people may not know, is that they have since sold, the DOI, Department of Interior, has sold numerous leases to BP, and that BP is not only now doing traditional oil and gas development in the Gulf, they're fracking the Deepwater Gulf. So they're using pressure in very different ways, in what may be, in my opinion, even riskier ways to do this oil, when they have now been shown to have had a corporate culture that was grossly negligent and ignored the dangers. And so for us, you know, it adds insult to injury that this company that still hasn't made good is being allowed to profit from even riskier activity in the Gulf of Mexico.
So would then the government be able to put some leverage on if they rescinded this EPA ruling that allows them, the government, to do business with BP again? I mean, I don't know what's going to influence the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, who now have this appeal from BP, given that their MO is one to lie to the country, saying that they're actually doing all kinds of good things, when in fact back in the Gulf they're stalling everything and not paying out these claims that they said they've paid out, and not cleaning up the Gulf as they said they've already done, etc. So, and then if you say that they're going to follow the model of Exxon after the Valdez spill in Alaska, where they just dragged it out in the courts until everybody just got exhausted or died of old age.
Yeah. I mean, I would hope that the Fifth Circuit will try to deal with this rapidly, but, you know, the legal process is really slow. it's my understanding, as you said, and from what I've seen, that you know, George Barbier was pretty careful, and I'm pretty sure he was, because he knew this was going to go up on appeal. I mean, you know, he's an experienced judge. I just think it's really sort of an untenable situation, and I wish the federal government would reconsider its ruling. I really think it's an inadvisable ruling. You know, and I have to admit that what's even, to me, more concerning is that we're hearing a lot of rumors that the federal government is actually going to open more of the coast, like the Atlantic and other, to oil and gas development, and that other regions of the country are going to face what we're facing with companies who really are not acting in the best interest of the country and are really putting us at risk.
Well, apparently Halliburton's already made a settlement of $1.1 billion. I don't know about Transocean. Does it exist anymore?
I don't know that it exists. Transocean actually was the first one to settle the Clean Water Act fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding that their environmental liability has been settled. They stepped up and put, I think, at least $1 billion. And so that money is actually already starting to reach the Gulf through the Restore Act. And is going to go soon, we hope, to some, you know, pretty significant environmental restoration projects. But Halliburton's settlement is only for economic and plaintiff injuries. I have not heard of any settlement of environmental damage. So those are two separate things.
Well, under the Clean Water Act, the maximum penalty is $1,100 per barrel spilled, if the court finds that that was done through simple negligence. But it's $4,300 per barrel when the court finds gross negligence or willful misconduct, which apparently this judge has found. So I guess that's where the $18 billion figure comes, right?
Right. And that will be, you know, the percentage that he's assigned to BP is what they will have to pay. And so, you know, the problem right now is that his next decision is how many barrels of oil were actually spilled and not recovered. And so that will then determine what the total amount that's due and owing by BP.
Well, didn't they lie about the amount of oil that was coming out from day one? They lowballed it ridiculously at the beginning. And it was only, weeks later, the thing went on for, I can't remember now how many days it went on for.
It was at least 60 days, and they did not admit for, in fact, what was interesting is it took the release of the photographs of the actual wellhead that was spewing oil, an independent scientist doing calculations, that finally forced BP to admit that there was far more oil coming out of that wellhead than they had stated that there was. I mean, I think it was by 10 time magnitude. And they still are denying that, you know, what the U.S. government says was released was actually released. So, you know, that's the next decision that Judge Barbier has to make.
Well, as it happens, it was actually, the spill took place over the course of 87 days in the summer of 2010. So it was considering more than we thought it was.
Right.
Cynthia?
It seemed like an eternity, I can tell you, when you live down here and we're working on these issues.
Well, Cynthia, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Cynthia Sartu, who's the Executive Director of the Gulf Restoration Network, a diverse coalition of 45 local, regional, and national environmental and citizen groups committed to uniting and empowering people to protect and restore the resources of the Gulf region. She is a lawyer with a Master's in Law and Marine Affairs, and has written extensively and testified about environmental issues affecting the Gulf of Mexico. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the religious and ideological underpinnings of the Islamic State movement in the Middle East.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
القلم بالقلم اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, who's a professor of history at Rutgers University and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to 2006, he worked as a political analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
Thanks for having me on.
And as NATO discussions are underway at the NATO summit on collective action to confront the Islamic State, what's your understanding of its ideological and religious underpinnings? Because my understanding from various things I've read is it's pretty hard to tell the difference between ISIS or ISIL or Islamic State and the Wahhabi doctrine of Saudi Arabia.
Well, there are pretty important differences between the two, but there's also a family resemblance. Wahhabism emerged out of the Arabian Peninsula in the 18th century as a puritanical movement closely aligned with the Saudi royal family, and it's persisted in one form or another through the 21st century. ISIS's roots is much more clearly connected to the kind of jihadi, takfiri political Islam, that is, the aggressive, violent, expansionist political Islam that emerged out of the 1990s, and especially out of the crucible of the Afghan war and anti-Soviet jihad. But we have to be really careful in understanding that Wahhabism and what ISIS embraces, you know, there's a certain kind of common vocabulary and there are resemblances, but politically they're very different kinds of things.
So the black flag of ISIS has a universal Islamic message, does it not? There is no God but God or Muhammad is his messenger. I think maybe I mangle a little bit, but that's my understanding. What is the inscription on the Saudi flag?
It's very similar. I mean, you know, we have to be careful here what that means exactly, right? I mean, there are lots of Muslims who wouldn't object to a claim that, you know, there's only one God and Muhammad is his prophet. That's not objectionable to most Muslims. The question is, what does that mean politically? What is the political work that the flag of Saudi Arabia does compared to the political work that the flag of ISIS does? We can get caught up and be alarmed by, and I think quite reasonably so, the fact that Saudi Arabia has beheaded, you know, quite a few people this year and ISIS has engaged in similar kinds of behavior. But we can't collapse them into the same thing. At least we can't collapse them ideologically. Now, we can draw connections between the two politically, but then we have to have an honest conversation about what Saudi Arabia wants to accomplish in the region, in the world, and so on. And I think it's quite stark from what ISIS wants to accomplish.
So you don't believe this idea that this kind of Mad Max caravan that's taken over enormous amounts of territory in Syria and in Iraq that, frankly, as far as I know, only has about 10,000 fighters, but it certainly has got everybody in the world on edge. They're not about to sort of charge across the defenseless border into Saudi Arabia and take over the Hejaz and reinstate themselves as the true custodians of the holy shrines of Islam.
Well, that may be their aspirational goal, right? I mean, they want to reestablish. They've claimed that they've reestablished the caliphate, right? The Islamic State. They may have grand geopolitical and territorial ambitions. There are real limits to their ability to wage an extensive campaign in which they're required to hold a great deal of territory. And as we've seen, once confronted with real military opposition, they struggle a bit to hold on to their gains. They've consolidated basically what I think constitutes a rump state in a weakened Syria and in a weakened central Iraq. But I don't think they can topple the El Saud, even if that's their objective.
But is there a possibility, as in the case with Al-Qaeda, did that brazen attack on 9/11, which then the U.S. actually sort of seemed to have fallen into a trap, the Bush administration did, in taking bin Laden's bait and doing exactly what he said they were all about, the idea of Christian armies occupying Arab lands, etc., which was our response. And many have argued since that that we actually strengthened al-Qaeda as opposed to weakening it by these actions. And we've called them jihadis, which can be a spiritual term, as opposed to criminals. Are we likely to fall into the same trap, do you think, with ISIS by treating them as this, you know, obviously it's got politicians fuming at the mouth, and it's even got Rand Paul now backing away from calling Hillary Clinton a war hawk to himself calling for the bombing of ISIS. So everybody's piling on, but is there a possibility that we're taking the bait again?
Oh, I absolutely, well, I mean, I might frame it slightly differently, which is to say that, you know, we prosecuted a war on terror following 9/11 that has led us precisely back to the same moment that preceded 9/11, which is to say that we failed utterly in the last 14 years, 13 years, to accomplish the strategic objectives that George Bush laid out and that Obama has continued. And here we are confronted once again with a radical, violent, at least outwardly Islamist political network that has been backed by Saudi Arabia and by others, and that seems poised to create even more havoc across the Middle East. I mean, do they have the capacity to strike at the United States? I don't know the answer to that question. It seems to me that their more immediate goals are local and regional, but is it conceivable that they could transform into something with more global ambition? Of course it is. And so I think the question that, you know, are we falling into a trap is one way to think about it. The other is that we've not only not resolved anything in the last decade plus, we've made the situation considerably worse, and now we're confronting the demons of all of that.
Well, there's no question that in the Bush and Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld team in breaking Iraq, as Secretary of State Colin Powell warned, he said, you know, of the Pottery Barn analogy, if you break it, you own it. Well, we broke it, but we sort of disowned it, and now it's come back to bite us. And surely,
well, that's right. Well,
surely that the environment of a failed state in both Iraq and Syria is a breeding ground, as was the environment in Afghanistan, the breeding ground for al-Qaeda.
Yeah, but I think we had to be careful to not have too narrow a view of what and how we should think critically about American engagement. And I'll expand on that just very briefly. But even in saying that, we also have to recognize the limits of American power. We break things very easily. We're not very good at other stuff. The rudderless nature of American engagement isn't just relevant for Iraq or for ISIS. It was also very clear from 2011 through 2013 that, you know, at the height of the Arab uprisings, the United States had declared a position of leading from behind. The Obama administration has not only failed to articulate a strategic vision, it's run away from every opportunity to think about what political engagement might look like. But the reality is, whether it's ISIS or whether it's other parts of the region, and even in moments where there's not clearly a civil war, is the U.S.'s most meaningful kind of engagement is through the barrel of a gun. We have not exhibited consistently either diplomatic acumen or other abilities to engage. And now we're confronted with the political consequences of Syria, which we refuse to engage in any meaningful way, military or otherwise. We're left with no other option but, it seems, to drop bombs and fight once again.
So do you think that, Toby, from these meetings that took place with the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran in Saudi Arabia a few days ago, that both Iran and Saudi Arabia are going through some kind of buyer's remorse for the radicalism that they've stoked in the region, whether it's Syria by Iran through its surrogates and Saudi Arabia in its Cold War with Iran by sending, you know, I don't know whether it was, I don't believe it was necessarily official policy, but they were emptying the jails and sending people, and a lot of independent money went from both Saudi Arabia and the Gulf initially to nurture this movement. I think the Turks also, to some extent, share responsibility. But Do they know that that this thing has backfired on them? Are they aware of the blowback?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that they're now confronting this, and I think they're both resolute in taking it on. Now I don't know that in any engagement like this that we want either the Saudis or the Iranians to be, you know, our best partners or anybody's best partners in trying to stamp out the problem. But I think you framed it well, that both bear a great deal of responsibility, along with the Hawks and the Bush administration, for creating the conditions for precisely this. But the Saudis, we should also, and this, it's the Saudis that I know best. You know, it's not as though the Saudis haven't confronted this before. You know, they live and operate in the moment. They have a series of strategic objectives and short-term goals in the region that they like to accomplish, and they funneled support into Syria in an effort to topple Assad, and ISIS is one of the consequences. Now the Saudis are confronted with ISIS as a real problem in Iraq and in Syria, and they'll do what they need to do in order to contain it in the short term. But we can't trust them to use tools that will provide long-term solutions to any of this. We should expect Saudi involvement to lead and result in as much messiness as the current moment.
So are the Saudi Arabians, not the country, you have to talk about the regime, because the regime controls the country entirely. This, in fact, the regime is one family almost. Does the regime fear Sunni radicalism more or as much as it fears democracy and political Islam?
Well, we shouldn't posit those as mutually exclusive. I mean, Egypt had democratic elections and elected the Muslim Brotherhood, right? And so then there was a coup that brought General Sisi and
Largely a Saudi finance coup, wasn't it?
Right. And so here we get to the crux of the matter. I don't think the Saudis fear Al Qaeda. I don't think they fear ISIS as a significant threat at home. They fear the consequences of either of those two networks having power in the region, and the kinds of trouble they can cause for the Saudis geopolitically. What the Saudis fear at home is the possibility of there being a Muslim Brotherhood type network coming to power, which is not a jihadi organization. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood is not violent in the way that ISIS is violent, and it has a much larger social base in Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis fear any kind of opening of the political system because they worry that a group like the Muslim Brotherhood might be able to gain a foothold and challenge them for power at home. And this is what I mean when I say we have to be careful in saying that ISIS is all, you know, that it's basically Wahhabism in disguise. And political Islam is a complicated landscape with lots of different groups. Salafis are not Muslim Brothers. ISIS is not the same thing as Wahhabism. Wahhabism is not the same thing as the Muslim Brothers. They're all different, and the Saudis have a very shrewd understanding of all of this. What they fear the most is the Muslim Brotherhood. ISIS is more of a pest for now.
But are they prepared to take responsibility and make changes? I mean, they're not. And they're not going to make changes in their doctrine.
I mean, I have a sense that two things are at work here. I mean, on the one hand, the Saudis have a very small playbook, right? I mean, they don't have a deep set of options available to them. They have a historical relationship with clerics who embrace Wahhabism. And I think the kernel to understanding Wahhabism is not its ideological proclivities, but rather the fact that Wahhabis say that the Saudis are legitimate political rulers. And in the crux, that's what distinguishes Wahhabism from anything else. Because you'll never find another political Islamist network anywhere that says the El Saud enjoying secular power are legitimate rulers. Nobody else would say that, but the Wahhabis do. And the Saudis don't have anywhere else to turn. I mean, they can't appeal to secularists in the kingdom because they've thrown them all in prison or they've persecuted them out of existence. And so the only real alternative is to cozy up with rivals. And they're too wealthy and they're too insecure to do any of that. So they'll continue to forge forward on the current path.
Sure. Well, Toby Jones, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, who's a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to 2006, he worked as the political analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the midterm elections are shaping up as the dark money election.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sheila Krumholz, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. She first joined the Center for Responsive Politics in 1989, serving as assistant editor of the very first edition of Open Secrets, the center's flagship publication. She has an article at CNN, Will Eric Cantor Help Wall Street? Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Krumholz.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So having asked the question, will Eric Cantor help Wall Street, what's the answer?
Well, there's no question he'll help his new Wall Street employer, Moelis & Company. I don't think you can take down a salary of $1.6 million without offering to deliver something in return for that. So I think it's very clear he will be delivering value for his new employer.
But he also got a hefty signing bonus, and it seems to me that Eric Cantor has basically stuck his thumb in the eye of his constituents in Virginia. First of all, in his campaign, he was barely there, and he was in fact in Virginia, in the Capitol on the day that there was a surprise upset from a Tea Party candidate who won the primary and toppled the second most powerful Republican in Congress. And then Eric Cantor just recently left his office essentially empty. The people of his district in Virginia don't have a congressman, do they?
That's right. And I'm not a political pundit, but those who are reading the tea leaves in that primary race were placing the blame squarely on Eric Cantor for having tended to his fundraising more than to the voters. And so he was masterful at raising money, and particularly from the financial sector, and within that, particularly from securities and investment firms on Wall Street. So it's no surprise that he might land there post-Congress. And yes, I think it's fair to say that he is kind of staying with his main focus, and that is tending to the interests of his cash constituents instead of his real constituents. And the question, I think, was and is, what is the impact on average Americans, including those like those in Virginia's 7th Congressional District? I don't think that somebody can turn around and deliver value worth $1.6 million plus a signing bonus without kind of giving something in return, and he has no substantive financial expertise to offer. And so what is Eric Cantor going to offer his new employer? Well, it's how to work the system. It's how to get what you need in order to, you know, at the end of the day, deliver a profit to your shareholders. And who, you know, is this a victimless crime? No, there are going to be winners and losers. And the losers are usually the people who aren't really part of the conversation to begin with, unless they have aggressive representation in Congress and in their state houses who are looking out for their interests to counter the army of lobbyists who are looking out for those who can afford to have that representation.
And Sheila Krumholz, recognizing that you're not a political commentator, it's nevertheless an irony, is it not, that the upstart Tea Party candidate Dave Bratt, a professor at a local university in Virginia who ran against Eric Cantor in the surprise upset primary, Eric Cantor's actions actually vindicated Dave Bratt's campaign, where he said that Eric Cantor only cares about Wall Street, he doesn't care about you.
Well, he certainly has done nothing to prove him wrong by making this choice. And let me be clear, I don't begrudge anyone leaving government and going on to fame and fortune. If he wants to go make a mint on Wall Street, you know, good on you. It's a shame that he isn't taking his career in public service and then moving to something equally or more esteemed, you know, some other way to really build upon his civic contribution. But if he wants to go into private industry, if he, you know, whatever the issues are that drive him, I would never say that you should not be able to do that. We want good, talented people to go into government, and there should be a path for them to do whatever they want to do, including, you know, making money. But it's, my concern is just what kinds of inside advice is he going to offer, and will that tip the scales in favor of that employer, that industry, in such a way that it has a negative impact on the public interest, on the rest of us? You know, are they going to be able to skew policy because they have a guy on the inside, essentially, to their narrow interests and away from the public or national interest?
And again, I'm speaking with Sheila Krumholz, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. She first joined the Center for Responsive Politics in 1989, serving as assistant editor of the very first edition of Open Secrets, the center's flagship publication. And she has an article at CNN, Will Eric Cantor Help Wall Street? And just before, I wanted to talk to you about this. There's a lead article in the Huffington Post, Sheila Krumholz, saying that the 2014 midterms will become the dark money election, given that the 2012 elections were the super PAC election. Will the 2014 midterms become the dark money election? But just since we're talking about Virginia, the sentence came down today for, not the sentence, but the verdicts came down today for Governor Bob McDonald and his wife, who were found guilty, I think he was on 11 of 13 counts and she was on 9 of 11 counts found guilty. And it's sort of an irony that he actually turned down a plea deal, and then he tried to blame his wife for his problems. And now it looks like both of them are going to end up going to jail.
It certainly appears that way, though I'm also certain there will be serious appeals lodged immediately. I think it's a sad day. Naturally, this whole investigation and trial has been, you know, really kind of an ongoing tragedy. But
actually, a soap opera, wouldn't you say?
A soap opera, and just, you know, an incredibly sad downfall for somebody who had. Was seen as a potential contender for the 2016 presidential race. It's just been such a rapid demise of his political career, although, you know, never say never. People rehabilitate themselves every day of the week, it seems. But I do think that if there is a silver lining to be had here, it is that this jury felt strongly that there is a line to be drawn and not to be crossed. And that they were willing to send a very strong message in support of laws and rules to counter corruption. And I think this can't help but send a deterring message to anyone out there who might consider violating the rules and taking paybacks and coughing up favors for donors and doing, you know, similar acts. So it's I think a chilling tale, and I hope it has a chilling effect on those who might commit similar acts.
Well, what's particularly ironic is that Bob McDonald was a protege of the prominent televangelist Pat Robertson. It sort of feels now as though Mammon overcame God for a jeweled Rolex.
I think politics draws people who have sizable egos, and I think you have to have that kind of tough shell to get through the rough and tumble nature of political campaigns, and you know, there are always going to be bruising fights, but surely, yes, this is also an example of just how human, even exalted public figures are. And I think the money is, it's we forget, I think, and especially politicians forget, that people are giving money to them for a reason. It's not just because they're a nice guy and they're deserving of our support. And it's my predecessor, Larry Meganson, a former investigative journalist in Alaska, I said, it's the Santa Claus syndrome. They think, oh, for me? You know, thank you. This is so kind of you. No, there are strings attached. People give money. These are not charitable donations. They're not given for altruistic purposes. They're given because they expect a payback.
So Sheila Krumitz, again, the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. Let's turn to the notion that I mentioned, an article by Paul Blumenthal in the Huffington Post. It's time to name the 2014 midterms the dark money election. And the 2012 elections were the super PAC elections. So will the 2014 midterms be the dark money elections? You're tracking it. Your Center for Responsive Politics, along with the Sunlight Foundation, are looking into these trends. How would you describe what's shaping up? Because we're a couple of months away now, aren't we?
Yes, indeed. And we've just entered the window right before our general election in which spending on electioneering communications must be reported. So there has been just millions, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars likely spent by outside groups that have been labeled as issue advocacy, so presumably having to do with social welfare advocacy and not political campaigns, despite the fact that they identify political candidates. So now those ads, even those ads, must be disclosed to the FEC. And so we're going to get a bit more transparency on the spending, but nevertheless, we will not know for all of those politically active nonprofits, again, the social welfare organizations and business associations, who's bankrolling that effort, who's really behind it, and what potential motivations might be propelling their spending. And that's the dark money that you've spoken of. And I think the label for this cycle is absolutely apt. At CRP, yes, we've been dogging this trail for a long time. It was our data that was the basis for collaboration with the Washington Post earlier this year in January, where we found that there was more than $400 million in dark money connected just to the Koch network that poured into the 2012 races. And much of that came through pass-through organizations that functioned really only to obfuscate the origin of the money, in other words, to launder the money. So I think there are a lot of signals and indications that what's going on is purely to pull the wool over the eyes of the American public, to hide the traces to the origin of the money and to prevent us from knowing what the connections are, what the potential conflicts of interest are, again, what motivates this money, and then to be able to track down potentially what is expected in return. If we can't know where it's coming from, we can't know who stands to benefit in the long run in terms of policy outcomes and the like. So that was last cycle already in 2014. The reported outside spending tops $175 million so far this cycle. We have crested $50 million in dark money that has been reported. Again, there's all of this other off-the-book spending that's been going on that's been labeled issue advocacy. And so Huffington Post today reported that the total dark money, including that, is up to $142 million. So this is going to be a seriously challenging cycle for the American people to really keep tabs on the money and where it's coming from and going to.
Well, we know where it's going to, don't we, in terms of the wall-to-wall advertising that's going on in the key states in terms of the Senate. In Georgia, the Michelle Nunn race, in North Carolina, the Kay Hagan race, and in Kentucky, the Alison Grimes race. Those are all Democratic women running against Republican men. And if you're in those states, that's all you see.
Yes.
And they're really nasty hit jobs, too, I might add.
That's absolutely true. Very deceptive and misleading and negative ads, and the money is fueling is so important because it's fueling those races, the ads in those races that are most competitive. And those are perceived to be the best opportunities for a pickup, and in terms of the Senate, the best opportunity to keep or flip party control and really determine the direction of our nation. So these are really high stakes. And I think that people across the ideological spectrum believe that common sense dictates, especially those of us who were alive or lived through the Watergate investigation, you know, speaking of investigations and corruption. How could one think that it's okay not to have disclosure? What's the alternative, that people are spending this money in the dark in order to influence our elections and keep us out of the loop? So I think, I can't believe that, again, across the ideological spectrum, this is not really a worrisome trend for our nation.
Well, we know it's working because there was a secretly recorded Koch-funded Freedom Partners meeting recently down here in Newport Beach that were obtained by Lauren Windsor of the Undercurrent. And one of the president of Freedom Partners, Mark Short, told the crowd of wealthy donors at this secret Koch brothers arranged conclave how well that they were doing in terms of taking down Senator Kay Hagan in North Carolina. And also, Short went on to point out that the issue advocacy targeting Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat in Louisiana, over the course of a couple of months, her ratings went from 54% to 39%. This is coming from the guy that's organizing the spending and the targeting of this very person. So that's literally from the horse's mouth.
Yes, I think voters, especially in these states where they're awash with political ads, that it pays to be skeptical because, unfortunately, academia has shown through their research that if we hear ads that are run by, say, the National Rifle Association or Planned Parenthood, we categorize them immediately. We either agree or disagree with them, but we know who they are. We know what they stand for. They actually have a social welfare purpose. You may disagree with it, but they don't exist solely to shape politics. They actually, you know, do have an issue that galvanizes them. And we can kind of either absorb it or dismiss it. But if it's an organization that's running a political ad that we've never heard of, an organization that has a patriotic or anodyne-sounding name, Americans for America, we wait and hear it and listen to it and pay more attention and give it the benefit of the doubt that it would not be due, perhaps, if we had a sense of who was behind it. So unfortunately, these are effective ads, and Freedom Partners, Mark Short of Freedom Partners is correct, that this is a very effective way to, in effect, manipulate electoral outcomes by keeping the voters in the dark about who's actually behind the messages they're hearing. And if they can't know who the messenger is, they can't consider the source.
Well, just in closing, Sheila Krumholz, it does seem that the abuse of these 501c4 social welfare vehicles, the IRS did, in fact, do some due diligence. At least they attempted it. And they basically put into the computer the word Tea Party. They flagged the word Tea Party, Patriot, and they flagged the word Occupy as well, so that they were sort of covering both the left and the right, the Republicans and the Democrats, in the sense that they wanted to look further into the legitimacy of these claims, which, by the way, they were getting blizzards of them, you know, and they had to process all this paperwork. So they were trying to just find ways to sift through it to find out whether there's any legitimacy to this sudden onslaught of 501c4 applications. And as we know, it became political football, and now it looks as if the IRS can do nothing about it simply because it became a political football, and it seems to have become a political football for the very results that that it had, which is it stymied the IRS.
You know, I think they are—they have been stymied for far longer than this scandal. That, you know, they, yes, it was a very ham-handed effort by the IRS to try to grapple with the surge in applications for nonprofit status. And but certainly from a, you know, a public relations perspective, it was mishandled. But the truth is that for many, many years before this, Congress wrapped their knuckles anytime they ever tried to investigate an organization like this that had delved into politics without really proving that they existed for a social welfare purpose. So that, you know, anytime there were investigations in years past, Congress cried foul, that, you know, declared that it was a partisan witch hunt, and really that has had a chilling effect on the IRS being willing to grapple with this issue. And even on a more basic level, this shouldn't be an IRS question. This should be, these are organizations which I think in a number of cases are very obviously exist for a political purpose and not a social welfare purpose. And even if they do have a social welfare purpose, if they are spending 50% or even 49% of their revenue and financial activity on political advocacy, then clearly the FEC is the logical agency to oversee and enforce their activities, or at least their political activities. So that's the problem, is that this activity really falls between the cracks of oversight and enforcement between the FEC and the IRS. It is a political hot potato. Nobody wants it. And we have really a lack of leadership and a lack of political will to address the problem. And so until we get that leadership, I think we're stuck with this current situation.
Well, Sheila Krumholz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sheila Krumholz, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan organization that tracks money, politics, and influence in Washington. She first joined the Center for Responsive Politics in 1989, serving as assistant editor of the very first edition of Open Secrets, the center's flagship publication. And she has an article at CNN, Will Eric Cantor Help Wall Street? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side to sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.